The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. And for the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the News and Observer. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, let me say first, Happy New Year, and allow me to remind you that, like last year, this year, that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or the travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. And on today's Armchair Traveler, the first of the new year, we're going to focus on the theme of making places more accessible to people with disabilities. We're also going to share a couple of stories about people who managed to accomplish great feats despite facing physical challenges. So let's begin with a story that's headlined, More States Strive to Make Parks, Trails Accessible to All. Now, Tom Peterson's story was written for stateline.org or .org and also appeared in the November 27, 2023 online edition of the News and Observer. We began by reading the caption to a photo taken by Stephen Gertner for the Dreamtime Tribune News Service, and this photo accompanied the article. And it shows Split Rock Lighthouse, which sits on a 130-foot cliff above the cold waters of Lake Superior's North Shore in Minnesota. And since August, the park has provided an all-terrain chair with tank-like treads to people with disabilities, opening the vista to everyone. Now the main story, and the dateline is Two Harbors, Minnesota. Perched high on rugged cliffs overlooking Lake Superior, Split Rock Lighthouse dominates the shoreline. Visitors from across the country make the 113-year-old beacon one of the most photographed lighthouses in the country. The most spectacular view, many say, is from Pebble Beach, reachable only by a steep, winding forest trail that snakes its way to Rocky Shore. The view is the reward for the effort it takes to reach the beach, but for visitors with mobility challenges, it could be inaccessible. I've lived here for 43 of my years, and I did not know where all these photographers were getting those things, said Jenna Odenberg, a disability advocate and accessibility educator who lives in Two Harbors. No longer, since August, the park has provided an all-terrain chair with tank-like treads to people with disabilities, opening the vista to everyone. It's part of a multifaceted statewide push to expand access to the outdoors. And Minnesota is not alone. In recent years, there has been growing awareness of the need to make outdoor recreation more accessible, said Mike Passo, Executive Director of American Trails, which supports the development of trails and greenways. Passo said other states, including California, Michigan, Vermont, and Wisconsin, also have made significant strides. In Minnesota, such efforts got a significant boost last year when legislators funded the Department of Natural Resources' $149.9 million Get Out More, Modernize Outdoor Recreation Experience Initiative. Major pieces include $34.5 million for more accessible recreation equipment and revitalized trails and parks and on public lands, and $9.5 million to modernize facilities such as campgrounds and lodges, many of which date to the Depression-era Civilian Conservation Corps and Works Progress Administration. Odenberg was diagnosed with juvenile arthritis at age 7 and began using a wheelchair at 8. Her access to the best beaches had vanished. Although she supplemented her manual chair with a power unit, trails like those at Split Rock Lighthouse State Park were too steep. Referring to her powered chair, she says, would get down, but there was no way of getting back. Track chairs. Minnesota, which has the nation's second oldest state park system, purchased track chairs for 5 state parks in 2022 and expanded the program to 13 parks, including Split Rock, in 2023. They span from the rugged northeastern shoreline, home to moose and wolves, to Blue Mounds on the state's southwestern prairie, where the trails offer the chance to spot grazing bison. At Split Rock, which attracts more than a half million visitors annually, officials tested the chair on the park's terrain, documenting routes that would fit the chair's range. Steep climbs drain the battery more than flat terrain, so park employees have mapped out suggested routes to tackle the 2,200-acre park. There's no charge to use the chair. In the first 35 days of the program, the chair was reserved 22 days, said Ward Wallen, park supervisor at Split Rock. People are using it. They're posting on Facebook and other social media outlets, and I think pretty soon it's going to be really, really packed, said Wallen, who added that park officials plan to test the chair for winter use. The chairs range in cost from $14,000 to about $20,000, according to Adam Henning, a marketing manager at Action Manufacturing, which manufactures the chairs used in Minnesota parks. Michigan has 13 locations, Georgia 10 locations, also were early adopters, and have chairs in multiple locations, he said. A lot of state parks have taken notice, he added. Michigan has taken a different approach, primarily relying on private money to pay for track chairs in its state parks. The Department of Natural Resources website lists more than a dozen parks and recreation areas with a total of 18 chairs in place or coming soon. It also includes something the Minnesota site does not, a donation button. Beaches and kayaking. Wisconsin's Open the Outdoors program offers wide-ranging opportunities from beach-capable chairs to cross-country sit skis, but the state is taking a measured approach to track chairs. Users' needs vary, said Nick Zusky, accessibility coordinator for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, and a chair designed for an urban park might not work for a hunting area. Also, money's limited. Iowa also has budget concerns and is exploring outside funding options for chairs, according to Sherry Arntzen, bureau chief for Parks, Forests, and Preserves with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. In the meantime, the agency has made gains in providing modified kayak launching areas. A current priority is auditing and updating facilities, including historic structures nearly 100 years old, to improve their accessibility. If there's things that we're not providing that we should be, we're identifying them now so we can plan together to make those additional modifications as needed, because just like other park systems, you've got to have a gamut on the age of some of your infrastructure, Arntzen said. Some state parks also offer chairs that bring visitors onto beaches or even onto the water. In several Massachusetts state parks, for example, visitors can use four-wheeled sunbathing chairs on the beach or three-wheeled floating chairs in the ocean. The Track Chair Project drew Minnesota's major news outlets to state parks, putting a media spotlight on the state's accessibility program. While advocates commended the commitment, the praise came with caution. There's still a lot of work to be done, said Erica Rivers, executive director of Wilderness Inquiry, a Minnesota-based nonprofit that promotes access to the outdoors for all. Rivers emphasized that investing in accessibility ultimately benefits everyone. We are all temporarily able-bodied, she said. Cheaper solutions. As much as technological gains and new programs help, experts and advocates said improving access does not always require major expenditures. In reaching a community that long had no or limited access to outdoors recreation, communication is vital. If you change clothing and get that information available to people, in my opinion, that increases accessibility by like 80%, said Passo. Every person with a disability has different needs, and if I understand what I'm getting into, then I can choose the experience that's going to be accessible to me, he said. Track chairs serve a certain segment of users, Rivers said, but she noted that her group favors less invasive means of access, a core value that goes back to the group's founding in the 1970s. Whether paddling down an urban river or exploring deep into Minnesota's remote, motor-restricted boundary waters canoe area wilderness, the organization subscribes to a low-impact, leave-no-trace ethic. You don't have to add that kind of technology, she said. Paso also cautioned that states should place reasonable restrictions on technology such as track chairs. Some states are expanding motorized hunting for people with disabilities, he said, but the disability community doesn't want to be kind of used as a tool for increasing motorized access in areas that really shouldn't have it. Whether states plan a high-profile initiative such as track chairs or something as basic as making a campsite grill accessible, planners must consider current guidelines under the Federal Americans with Disabilities Act as the baseline, advocates say. Signed into law in 1990 to prevent discrimination against people with disabilities and guarantee access in public spaces, the ADA has strengthened with tougher building and other standards in 2010. But the push to expand recreational accessibility is not about being compliant. It's about being committed, Udenberg said. I think having that mindset changed, that's not just because the law says we would, but it's because we want to. Well, Los Angeles Times writer Jack Dolan writes stories about people who are able to overcome major challenges. Visually impaired women makes journey up a towering summit is one example. Now, this story appeared in the November 24, 2023 online edition of the News and Observer. As Elaine Udvin approached the top of Mount Langley, a 14,000-foot colossus in California's eastern Sierra Nevada, she could feel the soft sandy gravel beneath her feet. She could hear the enveloping silence of the barren landscape. But she couldn't see a thing, not the craggy summit looking over the Owens Valley 10,000 feet below, nor the nearly vertical several hundred foot drop that menaced just a few steps to the right. Udvin, who had been born completely blind, would tell me later she was terrified as she matched strides with her guide, Therese Norbo. Keeping the lightest of grasp on Nordbo's elbow, Udvin concentrated on her own breath so she wouldn't panic and start hyperventilating. But she was also thrilled to be on the brink of an accomplishment that previous generations might have regarded as impossible. "I was just trying to keep calm, telling myself you can do this," Udvin said. At 46, Udvin, a standout marathoner, was attempting her first serious mountain climb and doing it on one of California's highest peaks. A mutual friend and longtime climbing buddy, we had climbed Mount Kilimanjaro and Mount Whitney together, had asked me to join the small group she would trust to guide her safely up and back. The idea seemed crazy to me at first. I understood that Udvin was extremely fit, but I had never met her. I also knew that running on paved streets is one thing, but climbing mountains, navigating over boulders, around downed trees and across cold streams, that's entirely different. Still, I'd been too curious to say no. And as we approached the summit beneath the brilliant blue September sky, I had to temper my own mix of exhaustion, anxiety, and awe at what she was about to accomplish. Udvin is among a growing number of outdoor adventure athletes who refuse to let disabilities reduce them to spectators. In recent years, blind athletes have run astonishingly fast marathons, scaled the towering sheer rock face of Yosemite's El Capitan, and climbed the seven summits, the highest peaks on each continent. Eric Weltenmeyer, 55, was the first blind person to reach the summit of Everest. His love of the outdoors began after a hereditary retina disease left him blind a week before his freshman year of high school. It happened at an age when you want to be so much a part of the gang, you want so much to be cool, Weltenmeyer says, and there I was being led in by my mobility instructor. I had to hold her elbow and let her lead me to class to the bathroom. He remembers sitting alone in the cafeteria of his Connecticut high school because even former friends didn't know how to act around him. The thought of never being in the thick of things and always being shoved to the sidelines and having a life with no adventure, no excitement, that was terrifying to me, he said. Weltenmeyer couldn't play ball sports. His dad signed him up with a group that took visually impaired people horseback riding, and sailing, and one fateful weekend rock climbing. As soon as he got on the wall and ran his hands and feet over the holes, like reading Braille with his fingertips, he was hooked. It was absolute engagement, absolute physical, emotional, and spiritual connection with nature, and everything I wanted out of life, said Weltenmeyer, who now lives in Colorado. It took Oyvind a couple of decades or longer to discover her inner adventurer, but when she finally did, the transformation was just as profound. Born in Korea and given up for adoption, she was taken in at the age of 3 months by a pair of school teachers who lived nearly 5,000 miles away in a remote village on the west coast of Norway. Her early efforts to fit in with the other kids to match their athletic exploits didn't go well. She's completely blind in her right eye and has just a sliver of peripheral vision in her left. It's like peeking through a keyhole, she said, and even then she can only see things a few inches away. She signed up for soccer and handball at school, but was always running the wrong way and worried about getting hit by the ball, she said with a laugh. Her insistence that her parents buy her bicycle ended in frustration and bruises. It wasn't the smartest thing, she admitted. I really wanted to be like the other kids, and I really tried, but I could never succeed, she said. So she set her sporting dreams aside and got on with life, college, marriage, kids. She was working as a physical therapist in the village where she grew up when, on a work trip to Oslo, she bumped into a group of fellow conference attendees in the hotel lobby who were headed out for a run. One of them, a doctor with experience guiding blind runners, insisted she come along. She was shy at first, didn't want to slow everybody down, but they wouldn't take no for an answer. Some of the best things in life just happen by coincidence, Oyvind said. The run went well, and not long after the doctor called to say an athlete he was supposed to guide in an upcoming half marathon had backed out, he asked Oyvind to join him. She had never run more than 4 or 5 miles at that point, and 13.1 miles would be a huge step up. Oyvind worried about making a fool of herself or wasting her new friend's time. Don't worry, he assured her. If we have to walk the last few miles, it's no big deal. Oyvind ran every step of that race and won her division. It was her first taste of athletic success and a watershed moment. It changed my life, Oyvind said. It completely changed how I thought about myself. Since then, she has traveled the globe, blowing away most of her visually impaired competition in 47 marathons from New York to Athens to Barcelona. In 2015, she won her division in the Boston Marathon, one of the most celebrated and competitive races in the world. Her latest interest in the Sierra Nevada began when one of her most trusted marathon guides, Andy Lauren, who helped lead her to victory in Boston, told her about his climbs of Mount Whitney and hikes among the towering pine trees and soaring granite walls in Yosemite. Oyvind said she wanted to give mountaineering a try, and Lauren, a friend of mine for nearly 30 years, asked if I would assist. We assembled a team that included two friends from Seattle, both experienced mountaineers, and three Norwegians who have guided Oyvind in road races. We picked Mount Langley, the most accessible of the giant peaks, just west of Lone Pine, about 4 hours north of Los Angeles, because it's mostly a long hike on a well-defined trail with only one brief section of mildly technical climbing. The day before starting up Langley, we did a short acclimatization hike from about 8,000 to 9,000 feet on the flanks of Mount Whitney. I had no idea this was going to work until Oyvind placed her hand very lightly on my elbow and said, "Let's go." As we ascended the initial switchbacks, I noticed she stuck her toes a little further out in front than most people do with each stride. It was a subtle and more graceful version of what the rest of us might do with our hands searching for the light switch in a dark, unfamiliar hotel room. At first, I warned her every time we approached a big step up or down, but it didn't take long to realize she could usually sense the size and direction of each step by reading my body language, the clues transmitted through her fingers resting on my arm. The speed and ease with which she made these calculations was astonishing. My biggest fear about taking her into the high alpine was the threat of thunderstorms. They can form quickly and turn a warm summer day into a freezing ordeal with rain, hail, and thunder that sounds like artillery. Worse, there's nowhere good to hide from the lightning above the tree line, so the safest option is to descend out of the clouds as quickly as possible. Before I met Oyvind, I wondered how we'd get her down fast enough in an emergency. After our first hike together, I wondered how I would keep up if she started running. In addition to her remarkable ability to sense what was coming on the trail, she had an exceptional awareness of the landscape around us. She knew when trees were nearby, how tall they were, and whether they had leaves or pine needles. That's due to a kind of sonar, sometimes called echolocation, honed by some visually impaired people, especially those who have been blind since birth. Oridvid says a friend who with two glass eyes can snap his fingers in a strange room and tell you not only where the windows are, but how big they are. It's not that I can hear better than you, she told me. I just pay more attention. The only thing that really scared her about the climb was the possibility of altitude sickness. She had never been above a few thousand feet, and she worried about how her body would react. Headaches and nausea are common for newcomers to the high mountains. Along with bad weather, they're the most common reason people who are otherwise fit don't make it to the summit. That weighed on her, especially in the spooky lunar landscape above 12,000 feet, where there are no bushes or trees, just low-lying boulders and endless gravel. Above 13,000 feet, the trail disappears, turning the final push into a steep, tortuous slog up loose scree, guided only by cairns, stone towers left by previous climbers to mark the way. As we approached the summit and the vertigo-inducing cliff of a few feet behind it, Oridvin didn't see how steep and how long the drop was. Lucky me, she joked, but she knew it was there. I could feel it, and I could. I could hear the emptiness, she explained. She knew to be weary and to stick close to the rest of us. I think I had the same feeling you had. But she didn't let it stop her. Marathons had become part of her routine, she said, but climbing a 14,000-foot mountain was so wildly out of her comfort zone that it brought back the butterflies in her stomach she felt before the first half-marathon more than a decade ago. She beamed as Nordbo guided her foot to the small, round metal disc embedded in the granite by the U.S. Geological Survey to mark the Mount Langley summit. Life can be scary, but fear doesn't help, she told me later. I've learned not to overthink these things. What a journey that young lady has. Woo. Well, since we began hosting Armchair Traveler more than a decade ago, we occasionally have featured stories about the Appalachian Trail, also known as the AT. The trail can quickly become an endurance test, even for the hardiest hiker. Adrian Murkison of the Atlanta Constitution is going to share the story of Zach Cross and what he had to endure in order to make his way along the AT. Now, her story, after losing 200 pounds, hiker takes on the Appalachian Trail, appeared in the June 2, 2023 online edition of the News and Observer. Zach Cross was sitting with friends around a campfire in the North Carolina mountains 2 years ago when he first heard about hiking the Appalachian Trail. It was his first backpacking trip, and a stranger approached to offer supplies they might need if they were making the entire 2,200-mile trek. The stranger said he had completed the trail years earlier, start to finish, in honor of his brother who died in a car accident. Cross and his buddies were only on a weekend trip, but the Tucker, Georgia resident said he came home inspired. I couldn't stop thinking about it, he said. I got home and started researching. Cross recently set out on the milestone hike, starting with the southern terminus at Georgia's Springer Mountain. He hopes to complete the 2,198.4-mile journey across 14 states by October. Cross took up hiking in 2020, a year before his North Carolina experience, to lose weight. Daily hikes eventually resulted in a 200-pound weight loss that has transformed his mind and spirit, as well as his body. Hiking trails over the past 3 years has taught Cross about his own self-determination, he said. The 28-year-old estimates that he's taken more than 900 hikes throughout Georgia and trails from the Smoky Mountains in North Carolina to the plateaus and canyons at Mount Zion National Park in Utah. Now he's ready to hike the full Appalachian Trail, known conversationally to enthusiasts as the AT. It will be an experience that he says is a calling. I've struggled a lot with self-confidence issues, and this has shown me that I can do anything, Cross said of hiking in general and his Appalachian Trail goal. I have the power to change something about myself. It's all about putting my mind to it. In April 2020, Cross had no idea he was about to change his own life. He says an unhealthy weight of nearly 400 pounds mixed with the pandemic shutdown led to depression and binge eating. It was the darkest 2 months of my life, Cross said in March of March, rather, and April 2020. He says, at that point, I was past weighing myself. I didn't like to look at myself in the mirror. I would try to diet and would fail. Mentally, I wasn't in a strong enough place to do it at that time. Then one evening, Cross decided to take a walk. That led to a walk the following day and another day after. Eventually, Cross began hiking trails. He will take a leave of absence from his human resource job to hike the trail. Because of busy work days and time spent with wife Grayson, Cross said he fit in hikes at night, usually around 11 p.m. At first, hiking was really tough, but then being in nature didn't feel like a workout. It became my happy place, he says. I started viewing it as a time and a place where I found joy. There's something of a beauty of just being out in nature, and you're just away from the cars and planes and the sounds of the city. Cross is now a fit 185 pounds, but even that was a perilous journey. Cross said he lost 100 pounds during his first year of hiking with an unhealthy diet, sometimes eating just one granola bar totaling 100 calories per day. By summer 2021, he'd become weak and lethargic and experienced a weight loss plateau. I was still near 300 pounds. I would lose a pound or two in weeks and then started to get depressed, Cross said. I was just trying to walk my way into a perfect body. Grayson convinced him to start eating normally, and his doctor explained that his body is not designed to lose such a great amount of weight so quickly, Cross said. He gained back 20 pounds but continued his daily outings and began to lose weight again as five-mile hikes turned into 30 miles. Cross said he intended to hike the entire trail a year ago but broke his ankle while alone on a remote part of the Art Loeb Trail in North Carolina. The experience, he said, showed him that he was not yet mentally prepared for the Appalachian Trail. I was hopping over a rock and came down on my ankle, and it went sideways and just snapped, Cross says. I was on a really remote trail, and it was near dark. I had to take a stick and some duct tape and wrap my foot up. Cross expects to encounter freezing rain, snow, and blistering heat on his current journey. At one certain point when hiking the AT, you're just going to have to deal with, I'm cold, I'm wet, and I'm tired, he said. The trail's northern terminus is in Maine. Between here and there, the trail draws a jagged line that mostly runs northeast. The big exception is in Tennessee, where it loops westward into the Great Smoky Mountains before turning back. The trail briefly skips through the southern portion of North Carolina and West Virginia before rapidly climbing north through Virginia, Maryland, and Pennsylvania. Just north of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, the trail turns toward the Atlantic Ocean on an easterly run through New Jersey and New York before again heading sharply north through Connecticut, Massachusetts, Vermont, New Hampshire, and Maine. Cross said he believes his weight loss journey has helped him prepare for the physical challenge of hiking the Appalachian Trail. There's still a lot in front of me, he says. I don't think a lot of people know how hard the Appalachian Trail is. I've done the hard part. I've lost the weight. Now I'm looking for that same challenge on the mental side. Alex Popp, a 31-year-old reporter with the Appen Media, completed the AT in 6 months in 2017, and he says difficulty of the trail is not easy to fathom. It's a mental and physical challenge, he said. Imagine taking everything from your life and basically throwing it out the window and going to live out in the woods for half a year, Popp said. It's like having or living in a different world. There are three-walled wood shelters about every 8.5 miles along the trail for hikers to set up tents and rest. Also, hostels located near trails where hikers can eat, sleep, shower, and pick up supplies and often catch a shuttle in the town. Well, by the way, this fellow did start his hike in May, and I have not been able to confirm whether Zach Cross completed his hike. As you recall from the story, he had hoped to do so in October of 2023. Again, he began it on May 1st of the year. Sadly, there are stories about people who've attempted to hike the Appalachian Trail only to go missing or be found dead. The last story posted about Cross was the one I just read to you today. And if I come up with any updates, I'll have them on a future episode of Armchair Traveler. That concludes our journey for today's Armchair Traveler. Hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, reminding you the content of our program is for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Comments and questions may be directed to 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.